We've arrived at Friday. It's time for a week in review. I'm Kate Archer Kent. First up, takeaways from where we started the week with the Republican Party of Wisconsin conference in Milwaukee. State Senator Leah Vukmir won the GOP primary endorsement for the U.S. Senate race. In her speech, Vukmir called herself someone who will fight like a, quote, scrappy underdog for conservative policies in the nation's capital.
I am your fighter. I have taken on the tough battles. Once and for all, over and over again, the tough battles, we have taken them on together. This year, we are going to finish the job.
Did the state Republican Party endorse the right candidate to challenge U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin? What are you watching for in this highly anticipated race? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Let's bring in the analysis with Tony Palmieri, a professor of communication studies at UW Oshkosh. He blogs at Tony Palmieri's Media Rants. Tony, welcome back.
Thank you, Kate. Great to be here.
And Kevin Benversi is with us. He is the research director for Media Trackers, a conservative media group. He's former editor of Right Wisconsin. Kevin, welcome back to you.
Thank you for having me on.
So here we are one weekend. Last weekend, we had the Republican Party of Wisconsin convention in Milwaukee, saw the endorsement there of State Senator Leah Vukmir. She won 73% of delegate votes over Marine Kevin Nicholson. So Kevin, Vukmir was lauded as a proven and lifelong conservative, but Nicholson has criticized her for being an establishment Republican. As this race moves on toward the August partisan primary, what are you watching for here?
I think the main thing I'm watching is what do the outside groups that are kind of behind the scenes doing? What are the Club for Growth? What are things like that? Who, let's be honest with ourselves, if you know the behind the scenes thing, if these groups weren't behind Kevin Nicholson, Kevin Nicholson would probably be an also ran. The reality of this race, at least from my turn, admittedly, I'm very pro Vukmir in my stance on this race, is that you have a very proven conservative legislature, one who has fought her way from the backbench to the position she now holds in the state Senate, who has a very solid record of conservative legislation, of fighting her leadership time and time again, even fighting her governor time and time again on various legislations, versus a guy whose essentially entire campaign comes down to two words: trust me. Which, as someone who has been a conservative commentator for almost 15 years in this state, is a little hard to take when suddenly basically his entire bio is I'm the former head of the College National Democrats, and then I believe his conversion to Republicanism and conservatism is true, but the problem is there's no record there. There's no what is actually happening to say, you know, where is the record to say I would back this legislation or I have this track record, other than saying I have a great bio and that I'm a Marine. As for the endorsement itself, I think it was expected. Vukmir is well known to a lot of the grassroots in the party. And I think it's going to be at least a boon right off the bat in terms of her fundraising and organization. And the real question coming for the August primary is Kevin Nicholson clearly is doing an air war. I mean, it's hard not to watch television from the Green Bay market or cable news and not see an ad from him, because if you actually look at that, the delegate vote, most of his votes came from outstate, especially the Green Bay, Brown County, Outagamie County, Winnebago County area. That's all the Green Bay TV market. Hers came from southeast Wisconsin and the rest of the state, which, you know, tells you something.
Well, let's get Tony in on this. So Kevin's saying Senator Vukmir is a proven commodity. What do you think of this, Tony?
I think both of these candidates have been extremely nasty so far, to the point where they've been called to apologize for their remarks from people on all sides. I mean, Vukmir is equating Tammy Baldwin's failure to vote for Gina Haspel for CIA director as being somehow aligned with terrorism. I mean, even Republicans have called on her to apologize for that. Nicholson, I believe, was the candidate who said that any military veteran who would vote for a Democrat is somehow not intelligent. So, I mean, they seem to be running these kind of over-the-top, negative, nasty campaigns that, you know, seem to be the kind of campaigns that work for Donald Trump. I don't think they work for many other Republicans. And so I personally think that Senator Baldwin is going to do well against whichever one of these Republicans gets the nomination in the primary.
Well, we have a clip here of U.S. Senator Ron Johnson encouraging Vukmir and Nicholson to avoid the mudslinging. Here he is.
I'm just pointing out the history where we've had a knockdown, dragout primary. The results haven't been all that good versus in my case where I surprised myself and everybody else by getting that endorsement. That really paved the way for a election victory in November. So just kind of laying out that history. And this is, from my standpoint, more about individuals. It's not about individuals. It's about, you know, us making sure that Tammy Baldwin's a one-term senator.
So, Kevin, is Senator Johnson getting at something here that should be that Republicans should really tune into?
Yeah, I just disclaimer here. I worked on Ron Johnson's 2010 campaign as research director. Definitely Senator Johnson is on for something. As I began my remarks, I said the real question here is what happens to the outside groups that are backing Kevin Nicholson. As I said, the Club for Growth, those that actually have the money interest in it, essentially, you could say, kind of keeping his campaign afloat in this air war, the super PACs, et cetera. What do they do? Because that's where everyone's kind of holding their breath and going, that's where the nuclear hellfire may come from in this primary. I don't think, you know, you're going to have a tit for tat here or there, some stupid things said. I was not, as Tony said, the teen terrorist thing. I thought it was a dumb comment. It was something they didn't need to say. They could have said, you know, that, you know, Senator Baldwin was insanely hypocritical with her Haspel vote and so on and so forth. But the reality of this is both these people want the job. They're going to be insanely competitive for it. And the big fear for conservatives is, again, with these outside groups, and, you know, this is why I've nicknamed the Nicholson campaign Mark Newman 2.0, which is, do they do exactly what happened in 2012, where we had groups like the Club for Growth, like the Senate Conservative Fund, like Freedom Works, like so many others, that were backing Mark Newman, who are also, by the way, now backing Kevin Nicholson, come in with this air war and blow the thing up. Their guy either wins or doesn't win, and then you never see them anymore after the primary, even if their candidate wins. So, I mean, that's the big giant fear for, I think, conservatives and Republicans going forward.
We're talking with Kevin Benversi. He is research director for Media Trackers, a conservative media group. And Tony Palmieri is here, professor of communication studies at UW-Oshkosh, working through the week's developments on Week in Review. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How about those partisan primaries, voters in the 1st and 42nd districts? What's happening in your districts as we move toward the June election? What are candidates doing and saying on the campaign trail? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So meanwhile, the candidates for the June special elections in those districts have been selected. Republican State Representative Andre Jacques won the partisan primary, will face Sturgeon Bay Democrat Caleb Frostman. And meanwhile, Lodi Town Board member John Plummer won with more than 70% of the vote, will face Democrat Ann Groves Lloyd of Lodi. So, Tony, Wisconsin's last special election in January saw Democrats win a surprise victory in the state's 10th Senate district when we saw that Senator Patty Schachner of Somerset defeated State Representative Adam Jarko. Are you predicting the same thing in these districts, or is it hard to tell?
I am. I mean, the Senator Schachner, that was quite a political upset, and it showed that Wisconsin is following a national trend that this is turning out to be a pretty good year for Democrats. I hope Wisconsin voters don't forget that Governor Scott Walker had to be taken to court to do his job and call these special elections. And the reason why he did not want these special elections is he understands that Democrats could conceivably win them. I think especially in that first Senate district, Caleb Frostman, the Democrat, I think is looking like a very strong candidate. there and has a really good chance to win that seat. I think the same thing could happen in the 42nd Assembly District. So it is unfortunate that our governor had to be taken to court to call these elections. But now that they have been called, yeah, I think Democrats stand a really strong chance of winning following national trends and the precedent in our state. And as you suggested, Kate, in the 10th Senate District, where a Democrat won, where she was not expected to.
Kevin, weigh in here. These were special elections Governor Walker didn't want to call. Where do you think these elections are headed?
I think it's going to be, first and foremost, a weird scenario where you literally are going to have these guys refile on the 1st of June, 11 days before they then have to have the special election.
Like deja vu all over again.
Do it all over again. So that was one of the things, and I was not a fan of how the whole legal regality of how this began, but the insane stupidity of how these special elections have come to come and on the calendar is just beyond there. Nothing's going to prove that more than in that first week in June, where literally guys who haven't even known if they're going to win in 11 days are now filing for the exact same position. They're going to be going after each other again months later. I have no idea how this is going to work out. I've known Andre Jacques for a number of years. I think the guy is great. My main concern is, and I hope he used this primary at least as a wake-up call, that this is not going to be an easy route. There's little doubt these races have been nationalized. There's little doubt that the Democrats in both the Assembly and the Senate rate are going to get national money flooded in from, you know, all these, you know, various groups. The Daily Kosh kids and online liberal communities are supercharged and throwing money at these guys. So, I mean, they should not. Neither of these Republicans should take this race for granted. They should look at the 10th as a warning sign. And, you know, and the other thing, and this is, you know, the other crazy part about this being a special election is what happens if you have the Democrat win in June and then it flips again in November and neither no legislation is actually going to be passed. That was one of the reasons why this election was, you know, opposed by Walker in the first place, beyond, you know, oh, my God, they could lose a seat. No, it's because the timing is so stupid for all of this stuff.
Well, let's move on now to the one-time child tax credit that opened up this week. The state's using budget surplus to provide qualifying families $100 per kid under the age of 18. Assembly Minority Leader Gordon Hintz says this is an effort by Governor Walker to try to curry favor with voters before the November election.
And, of course, with $130 million, we could have fixed lead pipes. We could have tested all the rape kits that are sitting around. We could have expanded rural broadband. Or we could have kept our budget intact, given that we face a pretty significant structural deficit heading into the next year.
Meanwhile, State Revenue Secretary Rick Chandler says this is much-needed tax relief.
It will really help middle-class families, especially working families with children. And that's where we think there's a tremendous need for tax relief, and this takes care of that.
So, Kevin, what do you make of the continued pushback from critics on the tax credits here?
Well, first and foremost, if I'm Gordon Hintz and if the report from Scott Bauer via Twitter yesterday or Wednesday was correct, I think he needs to send an email to his caucus and tell his members, don't sell this tax cut. Because apparently a bunch of them were doing it once the news came that you could file it. They were sending out emails to the constituents to go get $100 for a tax rebate. So I guess Gordon needs to get his talking points together first before he starts attacking stuff.
Tony, what do you make of this tax credit?
I think Governor Walker's been pretty clear at the convention and in some of his tweets that he really is concerned about this blue wave, that Democrats are making real strides that is going to include his seat. And this seems like, you know, a pretty blatant and pretty clear election year maneuver. A tax cut a few months before an election. I mean, how blatant is that? And I do think that Representative Hintz makes a really great point. If we've got $130 million, there are many, many needs in this state that are not met right now. So to not be able to use the resources in that manner so that our governor could, you know, help withstand a blue wave, I find that really unfortunate.
We're working through the week's developments one at a time in Week in Review. We have analysis from two different political perspectives. This week's, it's UW Oshkosh Communication Studies Professor Tony Palmieri, and Kevin Benversi is here, the research director with Media Trackers, a conservative media group. Getting your thoughts as well, 800-642-1234. Coming up, are you a homeowner who sold your property or may sell it to make way for Foxconn? What has your experience been like? What do you think of it all? Did you attend one of those town hall meetings on Foxconn this week? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in two shakes here on the Ideas Network. On a Friday, it is a Week in Review. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We've got the roundtable guests and you. Kevin Benversi is research director with Media Trackers. Tony Palmieri is a UW Oshkosh Communication Studies professor. Foxconn picked a master planner for the manufacturing campus it's building in Racine County, but critics say the pick, Hamas Company, shows favor for Governor Walker given the leader's involvement in Republican politics. But the governor told reporters in Milwaukee this week that Hamas's firm has a lot of experience with sizable projects, and that's what was driving Foxconn's decision.
I mean, that gets pretty straightforward. Their company does this all over the country. And it only makes sense that they'd be one of the people they'd consider. But we don't have any role in that one way or the other.
What do you make of the Foxconn developments this week? Did you attend a town hall meeting on Foxconn this week? What questions do you have? Are you excited for Foxconn or concerned about this stage of planning? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So turning here to Foxconn and the project developer, the critics are saying that the close ties of the business leader John Hamas has with Governor Walker is a red flag. Hamas serves as Walker's campaign finance chairman for his reelection bid. He also served in that role during Walker's run for president in 2015. And let's listen to State Democratic Party spokesperson Melanie Conklin.
It's just another sign of corruption in the Walker administration to be giving major contracts on something you did for your reelection to one of your largest donors and the person who chairs your campaign finance committee that doesn't fit with Wisconsin values.
So, Tony, starting off with you, are you concerned here about the ties, or is the governor right?
Well, of course, everyone should be concerned. This is the worst kind of crony capitalism. I mean, you have someone who's been supporting the governor and Republicans to the tune of many hundreds of thousands of dollars for many years, and now he's going to end up with potentially millions of dollars of taxpayer money to be the lead developer on this project. Is it legal? Probably. Does it pass the smell test? Absolutely not. Hamas, I believe, should be withdrawn from the project. For the governor to suggest that there's no other companies that can do this is just so bizarre and ridiculous. But it is a sign of the kind of politics that's come into this state, this kind of extreme, what I'm calling crony capitalism. And I just hope that voters are watching and listening and take this into consideration when they vote for governor in November.
Kevin, does it pass the smell test to you?
In terms of what?
Of the connection between Hamas and being with the campaign as campaign finance chairman.
The only smell test this doesn't pass is me as an old opposition researcher knowing that things like this were going to get looked at and then pitched to a media and a waiting op-ed writer like John Nichols, who's going to write a screaming bloody headline for the Cap Times or the Nation or where the heck he wrote that thing this week. No, I mean, the reality is, was this an open contract bid? Probably. No one said it wasn't. Is the likelihood that there are going to be donors to various political entities we are dealing with millions of dollars floating around? No. Yeah, that's going to happen. This is what happens in business. You know, you might not like it. It might not, you know, pass your personal morals clause, but the reality is this is what happens. I mean, I don't see anything wrong with, I mean, Foxconn clearly is trying to, you know, is trying to navigate the insane partisan waters of this state, where you have anything they do is going to get thrown under a microscope by Democrats who have been blazing hatred and anger since 2010 when Scott Walker won election to the state, then the recall, and so on and so forth, that, you know, just trying to get this thing passed. I mean, you're now getting all these things from Illinois and all these various editorial writers going, you know, maybe the Illinois people have a point about all the water that's being taken, even though Chicago takes more water in a day than Foxconn will take in a year. So it's insane to see how this stuff go on. But it's going to get pitched because you're in a very partisan environment. You have an election that people are, you know, chewing glass to get to for November, and anything that happens is going to get, thrown under a microscope. So, no, I think what this was a very good opposition research hit by the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, which the media fell for.
Well, chewing glass, I think that will be the quote of the day there, Kevin. So in addition to Democratic candidate for Wisconsin Governor Kelda Roy says she doesn't like the pressure being put on some of these homeowners to sell their property for Foxconn. And Roy has said this week that Walker should have considered the impact on local residents when he negotiated the Foxconn agreement last year. But the governor says that land purchases are a local process and that Roy's is being critical just because of the project itself. So, Kevin, what do you make of the governor's remarks there on how the property transfer is going?
I think Walker has a point, and I think if Kelda Roy's was actually consistent in her stances, she would spoke up when things such as the city of Madison were buying various lots and displacing the homeless and so on and so forth. She was silent there even when she was a state assemblywoman on these issues. So the fact that suddenly she's now running for governor and she's one of 9, 10, 15, 6,000 people running on the Democratic side of the aisle, she needs an issue to stand out for. So basically she's going to do what she needs to do to get attention.
So Kevin's saying this is a political move. Tony, is Roy's right here?
Yeah, I mean, this is symbolic of the problem with the entire project. It's never been about Wisconsinites. It's never been about local citizens in Racine or any part of the state. This is about a foreign company coming into our state, getting billions of dollars of taxpayer dollars to do it, and the governor turning a blind eye to our needs. We could have taken $3 billion. Many of the Democratic candidates for governor are saying this. We could have taken $3 billion and put it into small business startups in the state. And we'd be in a much better position than we are right now, putting it into Foxconn. So, yeah, I mean, I think that Kelda Roy's has a point. But, it is symbolic of the problem with the entire project. It's not about us as Wisconsinites. It's about the Walker administration, and it's about satisfying the needs of Foxconn.
We're talking with Tony Palmieri. He's a UW Oshkosh Communication Studies professor. Kevin Benversi here, research director with Media Trackers, and you at 800-642-1234. What was your read on the Foxconn developments this week? Did you attend a town hall meeting on Foxconn this week? What questions did you raise? What questions do you have? Are you excited for Foxconn, or are you concerned about what you see in this stage of the planning process? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. So these town halls going on this week, Wisconsin Democrats held several town halls on Foxconn in Green Bay and Sheboygan. One lawmaker, State Senator LaTanya Johnson of Milwaukee, says some of her constituents are concerned about the environmental impact and the cost of the project, including how much money falls on taxpayers. Tony, do you think the concerns and questions we're hearing will be resolved as the process moves forward, or does the administration need to be holding town halls itself, do more research?
Well, I mean, I think that these town hall meetings are good ways of trying to help people understand the extent of this project and the consequences of it. And look, the Republicans have been telling us for many years now that they're all about protecting people at the most local possible level. We hear that all the time. So if there's a homeowner who's going to lose their home because of some big out-of-nation corporation coming in, that's something that Republicans, according to their stated principles, should really care about. And I think that as these town halls go on, we're going to be hearing more stories like this. We're going to be hearing more about the consequences of this for taxpayers, for the environment, for our politics, and for other areas. So, yeah, I mean, I'm glad that we're having these town halls and that people are getting educated about the true extent of this project.
Let's go to Jill joining us from Wauwatosa. Hi, Jill.
Hi. I had heard that one of your guests just said something about this Foxconn deal being put under a microscope. And my comment is, it should be. This is the largest giveaway in the history of our state and one of the largest in the entire country. $4 billion, $4.5 billion, and that's my money, that's your money, and so it should pass any kind of sniff test.
Jill, thanks for the comment. Let's bring Kevin into the conversation with Jill's comment there, as well as these town halls. What do you make of them, Kevin?
I'm not opposed to oversight. I mean, that's what your caller seems to see my Microsoft comment as an apparent attack on. No, I'm not opposed to oversight. I'm all for oversight. This is a $3 billion project. By the way, I love how it keeps escalating. It's $3 billion. Now it's $4 billion. The caller just said it's $4.5 billion. What's it going to be, $6 billion by the time we're at Election Day? I mean, God, you know, get the numbers down, folks. People, this is you know, that's why I'm not exactly a fan of some of these town halls, because one, they're incredibly partisan events. I didn't even hear about it from my local Sheboygan newspaper, and I live in the Sheboygan area. The first time I saw this was from the CBS affiliate in Milwaukee, which is the number 4 station in Milwaukee, by the way, rating wise, and that how essentially these are apparently invite only events, or they're just emails are sent to Democratic partisans. So that's apparently the story I'm hearing from.
So you don't see these town halls as being authentic in terms of gathering the public comments?
I think they're going to have a very slanted take on them because, you know, State Senator Johnson is known to be incredibly partisan on some of these things. But she did not vote for the Foxconn deal. Not many Democrats did, because, again, this whole thing has been turned from a, hey, this could be a really great economic opportunity for the state, into how do we destroy this so we can send Scott Walker home in January 2019.
So it's become a complete political issue to you. Let's go to Mark now in Franklin. Mark, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm getting really tired of all the whining about this and the crying and complaining. And it's happening on every issue, whether it's a Republican or a Democratic issue. This state needs to stop this. And right now, today, it's the Democrats crying and whining again. Tomorrow it might be the Republicans. I vote independent. I vote, it doesn't matter who I vote for. It's that we are not getting anything done. I think Foxconn will be good for the state. We need jobs. The Democrats haven't given us jobs. The Republicans really haven't given us jobs. Jobs have been forced out of Wisconsin by either high labor or environmental rules, and those are all things that could be controlled, but they're not being controlled because everybody's so busy trying to get political advantage from things. And that's exactly what I think these town hall meetings are, nothing but the Democrats trying to gain political advantage on this entire topic.
So Mark is concerned about this extreme partisanship he's seeing in politics, and hey, these Foxconn will bring jobs. Tony?
I agree with Mark that our politics is broken. I mean, there's absolutely no doubt about that. But I don't think that people worried about losing their home, people worried about the quality of their water, I don't see that as whining. I think that people have legitimate concerns that, unfortunately, were not heard by the Republican majority. And you know, what I find interesting about this, and maybe Kevin can talk about this as a, you know, as someone who does label himself a conservative. What conservative principles are operating in something like Foxconn? There doesn't seem to be anything conservative about it. I would think that a conservative economic proposal for the state would be to support startup businesses, to support the little guys in all 72 counties, instead of some big multinational with a, you know, very sketchy track record around the world. So I don't know what has happened to conservative principles. It sounds like instead this is all about protecting Governor Walker, and in the effort to do that, trying to minimize criticism, put down the town halls as nothing but partisan. I think that's unfortunate. I'd like to see some real conservative principles out there talk about how this doesn't really meet the criteria for what a conservative economic development proposal would be.
Well, Kevin, before you respond, I want to bring in Chris in Milwaukee. Chris, go ahead.
Hi. My question, or I guess my comment, is I really do think that this should be under the microscope, looked at very, very closely, because I don't think it was looked at closely enough when the deal went through. I think it was just pushed through really fast. And I think it was pushed through really fast as a political process so that Governor Walker could use this as a feather in his hat for re-election. I think that was the whole thing. I don't think the people of the state of Wisconsin mattered at all. I think it was just for his political purposes. And that's my comment. Thank you.
Chris, thanks for calling. Kevin, your response to Tony and Chris here.
Well, how this project was landed, I was not a fan of, but unfortunately this is how you have to deal with the economic reality of when you're competing with states against each other, and you have to have various incentive programs and packages and various taxpayer incentives put on the line. This is just the reality of is it corporate welfare? Yes. Is it essentially a government doing all it can to land whatever business it can? Yeah, because the irony of all this is I keep thinking in the back of my head, what if we didn't get this? And then suddenly this comes out and you find out, well, you know, that Wisconsin was like, you know, just underneath whatever, and just if they only would have pushed a little harder, what would Democrats have been saying then? Would they have been going after Walker for not landing this jobs project? Would the guys like Scott Ross at One Wisconsin Now, who essentially has become the real, you know, Democratic talking point machine in the state, be attacking him for not getting the jobs, not being the job creator, going after the $250,000 number from 2010, which I still think was a stupid benchmark to put. But that being said, this is just how it is. As for all the, as I said, you know, I'm not opposed to oversight. But I do think that what you have right now is you do have a very, very, very partisan environment in Wisconsin. It's been insanely partisan since 2010 and 2011 and so on and so forth. And everything is just now is how can we use this to attack the other guys?
And we're going to leave it right there on that topic. Meanwhile, Governor Walker says he doesn't foresee sports gambling being allowed in Wisconsin after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled Monday in favor of states allowing betting on sports. Let's listen.
Well, it's in the Constitution. It doesn't matter what I think on that. It's in the Constitution. We pointed out before that that's not going to change. It would take a change of the voters.
So quickly here, Kevin, is the governor who has historically been against the expansion of gambling making the right move for the state, saying this is shut out, no plans here?
Well, I think essentially he's just stating the reality of this. The real question is what happens to the group that decides to change the state constitution to allow for sports gambling, and the rain from above, which will be the opposing political spending from groups like the Oneida, the Potawatomi, and the Ho-Chunk, who want to keep their little monopolies and their casinos up and running, or will there be some sort of joint effort to change the state constitution so that the Indian casinos can have on-site sports betting? That's the real question going to go forward in my mind.
Tony, any future for sports gambling here in Wisconsin?
Well, I mean, it certainly has a constituency. There are a lot of people who want it. I personally have mixed feelings about it. I mean, I'm worried about the excessive gambling and what it does to our state, worried about what it possibly could do to the integrity of sporting events as we increase legalized gambling on them. So there are a lot of complicated questions, Kate. You could do a few shows on this topic.
We're taking the week one headline at a time, going a bit deeper with analysis from two political perspectives and week in review. Kevin Benversi is here. He's research director with Media Trackers, a conservative media group. And Tony Palmieri is a communication studies professor at UW Oshkosh. Join in at 800-642-1234. A mile marker this week, yesterday, the one-year anniversary of the appointment of Robert Mueller, a special counsel leading the Russia investigation. Should he wrap it up? or keep going? Has it been fruitful, or has it been a so-called witch hunt? 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings, back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next on Point, Gaza violence, North Korea talks, perhaps. President Trump discloses payment to Michael Cohen. The roundtable takes it all up. Meanwhile, we're in the thick of Week in Review, where we slow down the news cycle, get some deeper analysis from different viewpoints. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Several news organizations took remarks President Trump made Wednesday out of context to suggest he was referring to undocumented immigrants at large as animals, when in context it appears the president was likely referring to members of a violent gang. Let's take a listen.
We have people coming into the country, or trying to come in. We're stopping a lot of them. But we're taking people out of the country. You wouldn't believe how bad these people are. These aren't people. These are animals. And we're taking them out of the country at a level and at a rate that's never happened before. And because of the weak laws, they come in fast. We get them, we release them, we get them again, we bring them out. It's crazy.
So what does this mean for our rhetoric and efforts to solve immigration challenges in this country? It's been a year since Robert Mueller was appointed. Should he wrap up the investigation or keep going? Call in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Keeping the analysis going with UW Oshkosh Communication Studies Professor Tony Palmieri and Media Tracker's Research Director Kevin Benversi. So as we change topics here, this week marked the appointment of the Justice Department Special Counsel Robert Mueller 1 year in. So far, the special counsel has charged 19 people, including key insiders in the Trump campaign, and it appears Mueller isn't done yet. President Trump marked the anniversary by tweeting, quote, "Congratulations, America. We are now in the second year of the greatest witch hunt in history." Meanwhile, Vice President Pence cited the one-year mark for Mueller's work as a good opportunity for him and the special counsel to, quote, "wrap it up." So, Kevin, is the Trump administration right here? Is this time to end it now?
Well, I don't think it's time to wrap it up per se. I mean, investigations take their sweet time, and I mean, the line about the witch hunt, I think the fine folks in Salem probably will have some words for to say about that. That being said, I do think there should be some communications from the Mueller team on where they are. I mean, it is a year. The question is, how long is this going to last? And I think that would at least be some indication. There should be some indication. How long are you? Where are you going? Where is this leading to? I mean, one of the things that, you know, is, I'm always been Trump skeptic on a number of things from primary on up to this. So as a conservative, but the reality of this is, as everyone's pointing, well, there are people indicted, but nothing actually for what the initial point of the investigation was, which is Russian collusion. You have George Papadopoulos, that's a great name, for lying to the FBI, but nothing about collusion to Russia. There's the problem is this, and we had the various competing Senate House intelligence reports, and I tended to believe with the Senate side because the House has become a giant partisan mess from both Nunes and Schiff, I don't doubt the Russians tried to do something. The question I think that we need to at least get a hold of is, were there people either corrupt enough to actually try to collude with the Russians and what they were doing, or were they just stupid and thought they could get to do something? I think you're leaning more towards the latter, but I don't think they were smart enough to actually realize what the heck they were doing. And I mean, I think that's probably what's going to happen at the end of the day, is there'll be a report issued by Mueller saying dumb things were done, but nothing criminal.
Well, Tony, given what we do and don't know at this point 1 year in, what do you think of Mueller's first year?
Well, as you said in your intro, there have been some indictments and some guilty pleas. So it looks to be a lot more productive so far than what, say, the Republicans did with Benghazi for so many years. You know, my views on this have kind of shifted over the last few weeks. I actually think now that the Trump administration really wants this investigation to continue, because as despite of the president's, you know, protestations to the opposite. And the reason why I say that is because going into the 2018 midterms and going into 2020, it seems like the one thing that really excites the president's base is the idea that President Trump is being persecuted by the all these deep state powers in Washington. So I think if there was not a Robert Mueller, President Trump would have to, in effect, create one. He seems to need that level of persecution to mobilize voters at the street level. Having said that, I do think this investigation is going to go on quite a while, and it seems like especially every time the president's new lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, opens his mouth, that guarantees that the investigation will go on. And, of course, we now have got Mr. Cohen and his issues. So it will go on for the foreseeable future.
Kevin, what do you make of what Tony's saying here, that prolonging the investigation perhaps helps the Trump establishment, the Trump campaign?
I think there's a lot of truth to that, because the precedent, and this is where the real irony of this entire thing comes into, is Whitewater and the Clinton administration, where it went on forever. And if Democrats get what they want, they get the House and they move to impeachment, suddenly, guess what? You have an entire political populace in the country going, why the hell are you doing this? Why are you forcing this on us? Why, you know, and the anger then goes at the guys who are pushing impeachment, not the guy who's being impeached. And I think he is right in the sense that, and this is just, you know, this is how politics have begun ever since the Clinton years, which is you create your own political enemies, and you have that enemy and you isolate them and you make them, you know, the target for your political base. Clinton did that for a number of years, first with Ken Starr, then Newt Gingrich, Bob Dole, up to his reelection in 96 and so on. And it's just gone ever since. And it's amazing to see this as a conservative who was never a Clinton fan to suddenly see Trump literally running the same playbook.
So what are the political consequences of this long term, Kevin? Or do we have any idea?
I think you put it, we have no idea where this is going to head. I mean, I would love to see some sort of, you know, light at the end of the tunnel in terms of all this stuff ending. But the reality is, I mean, we have, you know, a politics that is being, you know, continually increasingly tribal, where, you know, you could be for one issue one week, and then because the guy at the top of your party suddenly flips on it, suddenly you're opposed the next week. And it just, you know, happens on both sides of the aisle. And it's now more about rooting for the jersey color than rooting for a policy, which, you know, has, you know, infuriated me for no end.
So, Tony, tribal politics ruling the day, as Kevin is saying here, but the Mueller probe hasn't even gotten to dig deep into the Russian hacking yet. We haven't seen what is going to happen on hacking and indictments. So is there a lot more to come out here?
Yeah, I mean, there is the political tribalism, but let's not forget one of the reasons why the Mueller probe is continuing is because the Republicans in the House of Representatives simply refuse to take any of this seriously. I mean, they've already cleared President Trump, which really only guarantees that there's got to be some outside investigation of it. I think that Paul Ryan is a casualty of this. I mean, he was he says he's not running again because he wants to spend more time for his family. But my view is that he's been increasingly ineffective, cannot handle his own caucus in the Congress. And I think his legacy, sadly, will be that he was not willing to take on President Trump. And, you know, the Republicans' inability to take on the administration, I do think, empowers the Mueller probe.
Well, let's move on here. President Trump compared some people who illegally crossed the U.S. southern border to animals during a meeting with people from California who opposed the state sanctuary law. And he's come under fire for the remark and defended his usage of the word, saying he would continue to use it to describe violent gang members. What do both of you think about this? Is there a place for this in the conversation about immigration? Kevin, you first.
Well, to provide the context, he said it when he was directly asked about MS-13, which is an insanely violent gang that its origins are Southern California and Mexico. I mean, these guys, apparently their favorite weapon is a machete, and they are not, you know, their favorite hobby of using it is, you know, taking off limbs. So, I mean, in terms of that context, I think it's an understandable, and he has actually used it before. I was actually doing some research on it, and he apparently said used the exact same term to describe MS-13 in 2017. Is it rhetoric that's going to help the debate? No, but it's rhetoric Trump's going to use when talking about immigration. That being said, MS-13 is a problem. If it were not a problem, then why is Andrew Cuomo spending $7.5 million to deal with them in Long Island? So, I mean, the problem that you have is, I mean, it's very heated rhetoric, but it's not going to solve the problem by basically supercharging the debate.
So, Tony, did he go too far here? You're a communication studies professor. Are people making too big of a deal about this rhetoric?
I think what the president of the United States says on every issue is important. I mean, we have a president right now who likes to vent. And I don't think his venting is really productive for anybody. I mean, it does tend to fire up the bigots, unfortunately. And, you know, really what it demonstrated here was that he really didn't understand the California policy. The sheriff who made the comment that the president then responded to with the animal term, the sheriff was making the point that she can't turn over nonviolent people or people who have not been convicted of crimes to ICE. In other words, she was talking about the people who are not the quote-unquote animals. And so, as is typical for President Trump, he just doesn't seem to understand the policies that are being discussed right in front of him. And then we spend what seems like ages just navigating through his rhetoric choices, which I think are ultra divisive and just really not productive.
Well, on the topic of immigration, we're seeing this rear up again in the House with some conservatives considering whether to use a coming vote on the farm bill as leverage to try to block those supporting a series of immigration bills. So different parts of the party are facing off here. And meanwhile, U.S. House Speaker Paul Ryan warned a small group of moderates that it would be a big mistake if they continued their push on a procedural maneuver to force a series of votes on four separate immigration bills. So, Tony, should the party come together here until the farm bill is passed? What should go on?
Well, we've been spending a lot of time this hour talking about the politics of various issues. You know, I think it would be good for the Republicans heading into the midterms to reach out to independent voters, to moderate voters, to pass some kind of immigration reform that has bipartisan support, that has a pathway to citizenship. But what we've seen over the last 10, 20 years is that they will not pass any bill that has any kind of meaningful pathway to citizenship. So I expect that nothing will happen, and we're just simply at a standstill. It remains to be seen if the Democrats are able to take control of the Congress after the midterm elections. Will they be able to get any kind of meaningful immigration reform passed? That includes some kind of pathway to citizenship and that the president will sign.
Kevin, final thoughts, crystal ball, very quickly.
Well, I think the this is so much about the internal politics inside the Republican House caucus. I think this, if you know, the midterms go the way everyone's thinking they may go, this is probably the Freedom Caucus's last stand to stick it in the eye of Paul Ryan. They want to get, you know, whatever it is on immigration. The problem is there's other factions inside the House caucus that won't do things on immigration.
And we got to leave it right there. Kevin and Tony. Kevin Benversi, Research Director, Media Trackers. Tony Palmieri, Professor of Communication Studies, UW-Oshkosh. You're listening to the Ideas Network.